Donner, Dasher, or Comet?
I think Dasher's a jock, and Donner should not have been named after a cannibalistic party.
I'll admit, I did not think of that when I ever thought of the reindeer.
I just don't know where else they could have come up with that name. It's like not a common first name or pet name.
No, that's... Well, I mean, isn't there... Isn't there Donner meat? Like, isn't that... Like, when we were...
That's the, not... That's no, no, not no, no, a no. great start.
Oh, sorry, I was actually thinking, because in the kebab shops in Scotland...
Oh, like Donner kebabs. I mean, Donner kebabs, but again, yeah. Still, like, naming a service animal food is not great.
I mean, yeah, that's fair. That
it's just
fair.
Nothing about any of the discussion over the name Donner really leads to a favorable story for that reindeer.
It's fine. It's just survival of the fittest. I mean, sometimes you come up against adversity.
I mean, I assume they have to be pretty fit, but
hey, I mean, things. Sometimes you deal with difficulties in life, and sometimes you have to make tough choices. And along the way, those choices sometimes they're going to get difficult. But you got to just figure out a way to power through.
Are you suggesting that Santa Claus named a reindeer who was not living up to its potential after food and or a cannibalistic party to encourage and inspire it to do better?
Yes, because when the reindeer get out in the wild and things get tough...
Why should they be in the wild?
You never know. The sleigh might crash. Santa might have a bad day and things could go a little bit rough. And if they get stranded,
so
Donner's got the motivation that...
To
hey,
do what? Eat
hey,
all of the
Donner
other
has
reindeer?
The motivation to
or
become
to
like a
performing.
Wolf reindeer?
Like,
is that what you're saying?
I think so.
Donner's like, I got this, guys.
Trust
and then
me,
like,
I've been trained.
They wake up the next morning and Santa's like, hey guys, where's Cupid? Why is Cupid? Oh look, breakfast.
Yeah, thank you. That's exactly
no.
it. Oh,
Donner
I
walks
haven't had venison sausage in ages.
Donner walks up to the table bipedally and just sets
That's
plates
horrifying.
Down.
This is getting into like an Animal Farm territory that I'm not
yeah,
comfortable with.
It really
yes, because
is.
We weren't at Animal Farm already with a reindeer whose nose lights the way and then bullying other animals that cause a self-esteem complex for said head reindeer.
I feel like in our discussion about Santa Claus last episode, we wildly missed an opportunity to discuss how outnumbered Santa is in the North Pole. Between managing reindeer, who apparently have the capacity to talk or communicate amongst one another, thus forming a union. Additionally, the elves, of which we don't know the origins, and their capacity to, you know, organize themselves.
Or their effectiveness, like if we watch since our last recording, watching The Guardian, even Santa's just like the elves think they do things. Don't mind them.
Right, but even in that case, he's got Yetis, and I they are incredibly intelligent, and I would not want to mess with them. And honestly, given enough elves from Rise of the Guardians, I wouldn't want to mess with them either, because they're just like they'd be like, you know, chaotic gremlins.
Yeah, that's fair.
They're like minions. Basically, yeah. Which in a mob is quite terrifying.
Right. They just come in waves. There'd be no end to them. Like, you could hear them coming, but...
Yeah, it's like Antarctic lemmings.
Yeah, it's... This is really horrifying. It's not looking great for Santa Claus.
Okay, but on the flip side of that, when you consider, like... how many cookies does Santa get on Christmas Eve, right? Like, assuming, like, every family leaves at least two, that's, like, billions of cookies, right? So he just takes them all back to the North Pole because there's no way he can eat that many cookies himself. And it's just like, here, guys, have all of the infinite cookies.
Yeah, I suppose
that's which awesome. I don't know about elves and reindeer, but that would calm me down if I were in a mood.
But, I mean, we're also talking about the Santa Claus that's carrying around a mythical bag of holding that carries all of these gifts and things. So he could just be stowing away all of the cookies in some sort of magical space that will not really rot if it's in an alternate dimension. And he could just have a billion cookies just stored away in his bag of holding.
Then why does he ever need any more every other year? How many cookies do you think he ingests per year?
I mean, if I had that kind of supply and had his physique that was already... I'm already Santa Claus, so there is an expectation.
I mean, I'm going to be honest. Being Santa Claus sounds like the dream job, right? Like,
I don't know. I wouldn't want it.
I would.
Stressful.
Are you kidding me?
All those deadlines?
It's true. Like, the production deadlines. And, like, try to scale, like, unless you've got explicit NDAs signed with all these technology companies for the things that they're rolling out in November for Christmas. I mean, if you're having to, like, black market hack those things to make sure that you can create them and get them to children, that's...
Black market hack those things. We all know Santa's the one who made them in the first place. He just sends the designs to all of those companies. Alan, I don't know what you're talking about.
Plus, you get one parent complaining.
It's not
complaining.
Like there are scientists and engineers creating all this
you
stuff.
You get one parent complaint, then that parent is going to start a Facebook group to get all the other parents discussing and sharing pictures their disappointments.
But consider also, that's just my day job. Like, I already do that job.
Exactly. What I'm trying to remind you is Santa Claus' job is basically just your day job with more tools.
Right. Which sounds great because it's the job I'm already doing, but with infinitely more resources, access to magic, an army of
right.
help, which
and
is a huge challenge in my job, and free
families.
Cookies.
The world's happiness
I
rests on your shoulders, Kyle. How do you feel?
Great. That sounds awesome.
Oh my God.
So not stressful at all.
Anyway, all that discussion aside,
Donner,
I
Dasher,
would pick,
Comet.
I would pick Comet. It's just a cooler name. I feel like the branding is a lot easier. There's a lot of imagery involved that does not involve food. I feel like we could come up with a lot of really great TikTok videos.
Sure. Kyle.
Well, okay, I was going to go with Dasher, but then Ashley pointed out he's like the jock reindeer, which if I remember right, this is funny because I think we had a very similar this or that last year or the year before with some of the reindeer. And I remember a distinctive conversation around Blitzen, and I think we accused him of being a jock reindeer
probably.
Too.
There's always, one always has to have a crony.
There's,
so it's just a matter of like figuring out whether Blitzen's like the alpha or Dasher's the alpha.
That's true. I feel like we need to like settle this amongst all of the reindeer. Who are the jockiest of jock reindeer? And then we need to have like a jock reindeer games to determine like the winner among the jock reindeer. So I think I'm going to go Comet too, just cool. Because until that question of jock reindeer is settled, he sounds cooler than either of the other two.
I'm definitely going to go with Donner because he's seen some ish, and I think that he is an underrated, scrappy reindeer that Rudolph better look out, because if Rudolph ever decides he's going to have a bad day, I think Donner's right there to pick up the mantle.
Has it ever been discussed or discovered or established within canon what Rudolph's nose is actually made out of? Like,
nope.
Is it bone? Is it like an exoskeleton? Is it like...
I mean, let's be fair. It wouldn't be the only case of bioluminescence in the natural world.
Right, exactly.
So,
I'm just thinking of all the animals that I know exhibit that attribute and
right.
how it manifests.
So what you're saying is that Rudolph is just a giant fuzzy antlered lightning bug.
Yeah, I want to know, like, because if you're, because he's leading with that nose, so you hope it's not like the same consistency or texture of a lightning bug, because lightning bugs aren't hard to squash. Not that I go out attempting to do so, but having been a destructive child in the past.
They are not hardy creatures.
Right. So, like, you wouldn't want to be leading with something that is that sensitive.
Sure.
I feel like that's just pain. That's just asking for pain. Constant pain.
Maybe that's just Rudolph's secret. Maybe it hurts him, and that's what fuels the rage light. And it's basically like a Hulk situation, except the way that he expresses his anger is the light of his nose.
What media have you been consuming that every reindeer we discuss has a tragic backstory?
Look, I mean,
he's been playing too much D&D.
Yeah.
I may or may not want to have like origin stories of all the reindeer and come to find out that it's like the school for misfit toys, except for reindeer, and they all came from super scrappy backgrounds. Except, like, one of them's a Rich Pratt, and I don't know which one
Blitzen.
It is.
I'm calling it. It's Blitzen.
He's kind of got the punchable name.
The name is too close to the name Brayden, which I can't associate with anything other than wealth.
Sorry to all you Braydens out there who aren't wealthy.
No, may it prompt you to live a mendicant lifestyle and pursue Christ.
May it urge you on like Donner being his name and give you something to live and strive for. Hello, Mampersands. This is episode 162 of the MinMax podcast. And if you haven't guessed already, we're doing one more seasonal episode before we end this cycle. And today also happens to coincide with our monthly saint. So, riddle me this, Mampersands. Do you know whom it is we will be speaking of? I yield the floor to my two seminarian co-hosts.
Well, Kyle's the one that did the research this time. So I'm looking forward to hearing what he's found out, because I assume I know some of this, but I trust that Kyle's found like some really odd sources. So I'm looking forward to hearing this story.
I will admit I've actually found primarily one source, but it's a source that's collected a lot of sources. So yes and no, basically. They have a lot of obscure, like very early copies of very early extant texts, so that's pretty cool. That got me pretty excited. Yes. So if you haven't guessed, which if you haven't, bad on you, Mampersands, but we are talking about Saint Nicholas for our saintly discussion this month. Referencing that source, the primary source that I ended up using for most of my research was the St. Nicholas Center, which is based out of Michigan. They're basically they're a nonprofit organization, and their whole goal mission is to basically give information or be a provider of information for accurate depictions of who St. Nicholas
was. That's
so
cool.
It is, actually. I stumbled upon it. And I was like, whoa, this is perfect. This is amazing. And they do a really nice job. They do, like I said, they have copies of a lot of the very earliest texts that exist that reference St. Nicholas. Mm-hmm. But then they also have a lot of sections of history on like how the stories of Saint Nicholas ended up evolving into who we now know as Santa Claus and other traditions around the world. And I could spend, or anyone could spend, weeks and months on this website just digging through all the information that they have collected, because there's a ton of it there. So so basically, if you're interested in digging into any of this stuff yourself, you can go check out that website. It's just stnicholascenter.org. And like I said, they have tons of information all over the website. That details the life of Saint Nicholas, and then, you know, the legend as it evolves from there. So, so the thing about, talking about really any historical figures, especially, from as far back as this is, the information is a little bit spotty, and we don't necessarily have very detailed accounts of their lives. So with Saint Nicholas, that's also true. The first or the earliest biography that we have that has still survived to this day was actually written by someone named Michael the Archimandrite in the 9th century. So it was something like 500 years after the death of Saint Nicholas, which is a ways past. There are some texts that are a little bit older than that, and apparently a lot of it was passed down by oral tradition, but that's also a lot of how we get, I mean, a lot of our history, right?
Yeah.
So there's still something valuable in that, and something important in that. So,
I really appreciate that you say that, because I think as soon as people hear it was passed down orally, they assume they imagine the same way that any of us gets our gossip, and it's right. It's not the same thing. People were much more right. serious about storytelling and accuracy
exactly. yeah.
in oral storytelling than we are now.
Yeah, yeah, and that's the important thing, right? Is when you're talking about cultures and societies that have these oral storytelling traditions, the fact of the matter is they did take it extremely seriously, right? It was a straight up discipline. Like, you better have this memorized down pat, be able to recite it, you know, by rote memory, and have every last detail straight. I mean, let's face it. Like I said, there's a lot of things that have come down because of that. In fact, one of the things that they mentioned on the website is that, like, 400-500 year gap that we have between Saint Nicholas's life and his earliest surviving biography is about the same gap that we have for Alexander the Great. And nobody throws a fit about studying the history of Alexander the Great, right? It's the same kind of thing. And
exactly.
that was also passed down by oral yep. tradition. A lot of the biblical narrative that we have was passed down by oral tradition.
Yep.
So it's important to recognize that that was and is, in fact, a valid method of passing along information, but it's also much more, as Ashley pointed out, was much more detailed and much more disciplined than what we would refer to or think of when it comes to oral storytelling now.
I think I just discovered a new love language, and that's the defense of oral storytelling.
It's in thinking about it too, it's fun when you actually see that taken up in literature. Mm-hmm. There's a few stories that really lean into it heavy. Like, we haven't had one of these for a while, but hang tight for the Alan Roth this minute. like,
who saw that coming?
In book two, when Quoth visits the Adem, and he learns the Atas, the story of Sesera.
Mm-hmm.
Before he can take the sword, he is forced to remember over 400 or 500, no, it's even longer than that. It's better part of 1,000 years worth. It was held by over 300 people. He has to learn every story, who they were, who carried them, how they died, and how it was passed on, and whether the sword was returned posthumously or that. And he has to recite it front to back before he can take the sword. So, again, fictional story, but the importance of oral interpretation. Continue with Saint Nicholas. This ends your Alan Roth this minute.
Very nice. All right. So, as I said, the information is a little bit spotty, which is often true of historical figures. But some of the things that we do know is that he lived roughly in the early part of the 4th century. He was born in the village of Patara, which is... I think basically kind of like a suburb of the city of Myra. Myra is a huge port city, and it's also the city that he eventually became the bishop of. And it's in the area of Lycia, which is modern day Turkey, kind of southwestern Turkey, I believe. So he was born to wealthy family. His parents were nobles, so he was born into wealth. And one of the interesting things, and this is preserved as like a really important detail of his life, was that even as an infant, while he was breastfeeding, he just naturally, or for whatever reason, he would just not eat on Wednesdays and Fridays, which it just so happened were the properly determined fasting days for the church at that time. So basically, straight up, as an infant, straight out of the womb, he was already fasting and living within the proper church calendar. So
I find that so funny, because I know enough moms who have like worried over their kids' eating habits at a very young age and have had some very strange sort of patterns where they just could not force them to eat. So
right.
It's not too difficult for me to believe that St. Nicholas as a baby just so happened to be finicky enough to right. those were the two days he just wouldn't.
Right. Which, so that, and then the other thing about his infancy that's interesting is there's some comparison between him and John the Baptist in the early texts, because, in John the Baptist's case, basically, when John was born, he cured his mother of her physical ailments. On the flip side, when St. Nicholas is born, his mother became sterile. She couldn't have any more kids after this. So Nicholas was the only one. Yeah. So there's like some weird comparison of like, oh, look, he's like John the Baptist in this sense, except for it's just like a flipping the script kind of situation.
I mean, hey, if you're going to be compared to somebody, not a bad comparison.
No, not at all.
That's true.
Though I suppose if he's like fasting and giving away things at young ages, it's probably best that they stopped at one, because can you imagine like five of those kids?
Yeah, right.
We were a wealthy family.
It's also getting into like a Jesus sibling situation where it's just like, we don't get too much about the rest of the siblings, but all of them, especially if Nicholas had siblings and is that pious, that young, can you imagine that? Look at this little guy. Like, what the is he doing? Like, what is he getting on about? Like, it would be, we might not have St. Nick.
I feel like a lot of your baggage as the brother of a priest is coming out right now.
That's a good point. Interesting.
It's fine.
It would give credence to what was that one movie? It came out maybe like 5-6 years ago, if not a little bit longer. That was about the brother, like the younger brother of Santa Claus, who was a total screw up and couldn't. Yeah, that's the one.
Was, yeah.
Yep. I think there's been a couple of them actually, but anyway, yeah. That would actually create a whole new dimension of the legend if that had been the case, but it wasn't. So, so those were two things in his early, well, in his infancy that kind of helped to start to set the tone that he would become the patron saint of children, because he was considered quote unquote holy even as a baby. And so that was kind of one of the things that helped to set the tone. So as I said, his parents were nobles. They were wealthy. When the time came that they died, Nicholas inherited all their wealth, and then he basically got a reputation for being extremely generous, because he just gave his wealth away constantly and just basically gave it all to the poor. The big story around that is probably the biggest reason that we have the tales and legends of Santa that we do, or St. Nicholas that we do, is that he had some stories say it's neighbor, someone who lived nearby, a family in the town, whatever. But there was a family. It was a father and three daughters. And they had been wealthy, but for whatever reason, they fell on hard times and reached the point where they were basically in poverty. They had almost nothing left. And so it got to the point where they were so desperate that the father was considering basically selling his daughters into prostitution because there were just no other options. He had no other way to make money and for them to survive. So he had this plan. Nicholas gets wind of it. And what he does is he sneaks out in the middle of the night with a bag of gold and he tosses it in through their window. So they wake up in the morning, they find the bag of gold, and the father ends up using it to pay the dowry for his eldest daughter. So the eldest daughter is able to get married, and therefore be supported. And then once she's married, then Nicholas goes again and he throws another bag of gold in through the window at night. And then that bag of gold is used to pay the dowry for the second daughter, the middle daughter. So she also gets married. Happy days, happy days. And then Nicholas goes to do it again for the third daughter. Well, by this point, of course, the father's become suspicious. He wants to know. Suspicious is a bad word. He's excited. He wants to show gratitude for whoever it is that's delivering this money to him. And so he stays up. And the third bag is delivered in the middle of the night again. And the father manages to catch St. Nicholas and sees him, taking off in the dead of night. And he chases him down and catches him, thanks him, praises God. It becomes a whole big thing. So basically in that way, all three of the daughters receive their dowry money. They're all married. And Nicholas is able to help that family. So that's kind of the other story that really cements Nicholas as, again, the patron saint of children, because he becomes known for giving these gifts, especially to these three girls. And so those are kind of the early life tales that establish, and again, his generosity and things like that. So eventually he ends up becoming the bishop of the city of Myra. And this is actually a super interesting story too, because basically the way the story goes is the previous bishop had died and they were looking for someone to replace him. And I am not familiar enough with the structure to know exactly who, but somebody in the church basically like received a vision and was told, wait by the door of the church, and the first person who comes in, that's the person who's going to be your new bishop. And it just so happened that the next person to wander in the door was Nicholas. Huh. And so that's how he becomes the Bishop of Myra. Yeah, like no big deal. It's just
like either
like
a really great day for him or a really bad day.
Yeah, right. So that's how he ends up becoming the bishop in Myra. Beyond that, we don't know a whole lot about his life. There is a story floating around out there that isn't really like, there's a lot of scholarship kind of for, but mostly against this instance, in which at the Council of Nicaea, which was one of the earliest ecumenical councils, in fact, it was the first, if I remember right. Right, Ashley?
Yeah, I think you're right.
Nicaea was the first, yeah. In which basically the early church was trying to gather and deal with a number of different heresies that had started popping up. And they basically met to try and decide, okay, what is it that we actually believe? What is, what is the nature of Christ, so on and so forth. And so the story goes that Nicholas was present at this council, and he punched Arius, who was the heretic that they were arguing against, basically, punched him in the face because he was just so upset that this guy could just have things so terribly wrong. And again, whether or not that's true, there's a lot of argument against, but it does kind of cement one detail about St. Nicholas that I think really affects the legend, if nothing else, which is he had a temper, right? And I think we see that in a lot of like the modern retellings of Santa Claus. Like there are a lot of instances where we see kind of an angry Santa Claus or a Santa Claus who loses his temper. And I think like Miracle at 34th Street is a good example of that, right? So again, whether or not that story is true, I think it's funny. It's a cool story. I like the idea that it's true, even if it probably isn't. So that's, again, as I said, that's kind of the bulk of what we have in terms of the factual account of his life. But some of the other stories that we have, there are a couple of other really interesting ones that were passed down from within his lifetime. So actually, at least based on what the St. Nicholas Center has, the earliest surviving story that was actually documented and written down was told, it sounds like it was told at the Feast of St. Nicholas around 400 AD. So this would have been give or take 50, 60, 70-ish years after Nicholas's death. We don't have the exact dates on anything, so it's, you know, it's hard to know, but relatively close to his lifetime anyway. Mm-hmm. So basically the story goes that there was some sort of like riot, rebellion kind of thing happening within the empire. So Constantine sends a group of soldiers out to go and deal with this. So as they're out sailing, they stop at Myra, which, as I said, was a port city. So it was obviously kind of a common stopping off point. So they stop there to restock and stuff. And I think there was some detail, something about, you know, they didn't have a good wind or something like that. So they ended up staying in port for a short time. So some of the sailors go onto shore. Well, as they go onto shore, for whatever reason, a group of people impersonate some of these soldiers and then just started causing riots within the city. So basically, the city guard or whomever arrest these sailors because, again, you know, someone had impersonated them, and they're set to be executed, basically. Well, it just so happened that St. Nicholas, who, again, was the bishop of the city at the time, ends up coming down into the city to see what in the world is going on, and some soldiers come up to him and say, there's these guys who are set to be executed for no reason. Like, this was a whole thing. So again, the story goes that Nicholas comes down into, you know, goes and finds the place where they're about to be executed, and he actually, like, straight up, like Hollywood movie style, like, catches the axe of the guy who's trying to behead them or whatever it was, or the sword. I think it was probably a sword, but anyway, he like physically stops the executioner from killing these soldiers and gets to the bottom of it. So that's an interesting story, but it doesn't actually stop there, because then the sailors get back on their ship, they go out, they sail to wherever it was that they were going, and they deal with the rebellion as they were told, and end up sailing back to Constantinople. Well, they get back there, and there's these three captains who are different from the three soldiers. That was confusing. I had to go back and reread the story like six times to make sure I was clear. But there's these three captains who led this battalion of soldiers. And of course, they come back and they're being highly praised and everyone's saying what a great job that they did. And so the master of arms gets jealous of them and decides that he doesn't like them because they are getting all these accolades and stuff. So he basically forges evidence that these three men are involved in a conspiracy against Constantine. And so, of course, then Emperor Constantine is mad and he arrests the three men, and they're set to be executed now. So the three men, the three captains, remember what happened with the sailors when they stopped off in Myra before, and they basically give an intercessory prayer to St. Nicholas, begging for his help. And so the story goes that Nicholas appears to them and then appears to Constantine and to this master of arms, which was a guy named... The master of arms reported this to Oblabius, who was basically like a Roman ruler at the time, who would have been in charge of dealing with these kinds of things.
Sure.
And so he basically, the story goes that Nicholas appears in a vision to both Oblabius and to Emperor Constantine, saying, nope, these men are innocent. You know, this is basically what happened. And so the men's lives were saved. And this is, again, super interesting because this is during St. Nicholas's lifetime, which I think, I'm not super well versed in vast numbers of stories, but I think it's a little bit odd to have visions of saints appearing while they're still alive. I think mm-hmm. it's a little more common to have like visions of past figures, right? Like even within biblical stories, we see like when Moses appears at the Transfiguration and things like that. So yeah, basically these three men are saved. I think the interesting thing about this story, the thing that I kind of latched onto is because of these specific instances, there becomes a connection between Nicholas and sailors, where a lot of sailors then, and there's another story that I'll get to in a minute that involves sailors, start to, I would imagine, you know, it's not hard to see if this is what happens, that sailors are going to be like, wow, like this is a cool story. Let's share this story. And of course, they're sailing all over the place. So they start sharing that story in other places. And it's not hard to see how a legend starts to build around that, right? Like the story is just going to be told in a lot of places. And then that's where you start to get the casual kind of mutation, which is the kind of thing that we expect when we talk about oral storytelling today, right? That's where things become different and legends get born. And so that, I think, is a big part of kind of how the story starts to grow. So the other interesting story, and this one gets a little convoluted too, so you'll have to bear with me for a second. But one of the things that Nicholas was really passionate about when he was a bishop of Myra was destroying the idolatrous temples and places of worship that weren't dedicated to Christ throughout the city of Myra. So he was known for kind of destroying a lot of these sites. One of the big ones was the Temple of Artemis that still existed within the city. So he destroyed that, and with, of course, a lot of poetic and glorifying language, the author of the text, you know, says like, oh, he tore down these idolatrous places, and the demons who are within were released and cast out into the world, kind of thing, right? So that becomes important because then there's a later story where after he dies, he's interned at a tomb in Myra. And of course, like I said, his story has started to be spread throughout the region. So there's a bunch of people who want to make a pilgrimage to the tomb of Saint Nicholas. And they're approached by this woman who, according to the story, is one of the demons who is cast out from the Temple of Artemis, who is really mad. So of course she's trying to get vengeance. And so she approaches one of these sailors who's going to make this pilgrimage and basically says, hey, I want to make an offering. I can't make the trip myself. Will you take this with you? And she gives them a jug of oil, which is supposedly contains, basically it's just like bottled evil. I'm not sure how that works, but she gives these sailors a bottle of evil. And that's what she wants them to take to the temple. I know, it's so crazy. And so they take it, you know, thinking, oh, it's just, you know, some woman who wants us to bring an offering. Great. So they take it. Well, they're out at sea for a day when they have another vision of Nicholas telling them, nope, that this is what that is, that woman is actually a demon that was cast out from this temple. You know, you need to get rid of that jug because it just contains evil. So they wake up in the morning, the sailors go out, they throw it into the sea, and then there's like a firestorm that starts to happen. Like the sky lights up with like smoke and fire, and there's like sparks falling from the sky, and it's all sorts of craziness. Casual. And so basically they pray to Saint Nicholas again, and then after a time, he rescues them from the storm. So again, you have this other huge story of sailors being rescued by Saint Nicholas. And so again, like I said, I think that feeds so much into why this legend, maybe more than most others, ends up spreading so significantly, is because again, you know, the connection with sailors makes a huge difference, I think.
That's really cool. So, I'd never made the connection between Saint Nicholas and sailors. That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, right. And I don't know. I mean, that's just me speculating that would be a big part of it. There are other saints and other figures who have been associated with sailors too that, you know, aren't necessarily as big, but I would imagine it didn't hurt the development of the legend at all.
Yeah.
I actually never realized that he was from modern day Turkey either, which, like, thinking about as we've talked about films in the past couple of episodes, like thinking about the Guardians where he's using two sabers that look very much like falchions, like that would have been very usual in the region, like that all plays into it. And it's just like, okay, that's...
I do like any Saint Nicholas story that isn't just British,
right?
Because that doesn't track at all. But I think, especially since, Kyle, you mentioned like a cinematic sort of moment in the saving of those three sailors, started imagining how epic it would be to have a film that aired more on the historic side, like you've been pulling through with some of these more amazing elements of his narrative. And like, I just imagine him, you know, after a good old day of destroying temples with what I'm imagining is just like busting up statues with his crozier, then like running into town and also stopping the sword with his crozier. Like, I just imagine him using his crozier for everything.
Yeah, right.
And
yeah,
like,
no, absolutely. It's
like the canons of the church are being like, please stop. Like, that is a priceless ornament of the church. Please stop using it in such violent ways. We have to polish it later.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's an interesting thing for me, and I've always been curious, especially with the St. Nicholas Santa Claus thing, but it's always interesting to see or wonder at the real details that still filter in through the stories and legends, right? Like, another good example of this would be like King Arthur or Robin Hood, terms of British legends. Like, what are the historical facts? Like, who was this person? What did they do that actually made this story, you know, just develop from them? And I like those little details that have really survived and that still show like the true kernels of St. Nicholas and who he was based on the information that we have that still survive into these narratives today. You know, I think that like really gruff, really no nonsense, but ultimately very compassionate and kind vision of Santa Claus, which is something we kind of talked about last week. I think that's a big part of it. And I think that's really cool to see where some of that has come from, you know, throughout the centuries.
Yeah. So I really appreciate that you've pulled in all these other stories that I actually was completely unfamiliar with. One that I want to ask you about, and I don't know if you came across it, that is always missed or intentionally set aside, because usually, you know, like a lot of children's ministry programs are like, it's Saint Nick Sunday, like we're gonna have the kids set their shoes outside the sanctuary and film with gold coins and oranges and such while they're in the service, and we'll have like someone dress up in the bishop's stole and walk out and like read happy letters and stuff. They don't talk about this story because understandably, it would freak a lot of kids out. But it kind of like errs on that sort of folklore-y, like danger in the winter type situation.
Sure.
That I really want, like, let me get to it. Because you'll understand immediately why people don't tell this one, especially to children.
I've got a theme song for this already.
Oh,
so.
No. Okay. So, had you come across a story about the three children that he saves from being eaten?
I think I saw vague references. I ended up focusing more on his historical lifetime, so I saw references to other stories. I just didn't have time to get to them, which is...
Okay.
On my to-do list for sure. Like, I definitely want to revisit those. But
this one, like, is one of the more like out there stories, but I love it so much because it's like a cool miracle if this did indeed happen. This is one that like even I am just like, that's a bit much, but as a story, super love. So there's a point during a famine when suddenly like Saint Nicholas realizes, hey, three of my students are missing. And so he's like searching for them and looking high and low throughout the city and eventually finds their bodies in a tub in an inn, cut up and pickled. And like there are some images, like old images of like these kids being made into sausage. And so like there's a kid like in a meat grinder where like half of him is sticking out, or like little legs are sticking out or something. And he like undoes the process miraculously. So like you can understand why, one, people don't tell this story ever because it's horrifying. And then two, why it would be really hard to believe this happening. Like the idea of someone dreaming about St. Nicholas and being saved miraculously, those are things that I'm like, Yeah, I could see that happening. But the idea of him, like, knitting children back together after being cut up and pickled, a little difficult to kind of conceive of.
Yeah, yeah, it's a bit much.
Right? Exactly. So it just adds to the mythos of him being, like, the protector of children.
Yeah,
I think it's right. Because he's protecting children from people who are in... this is an act of desperation, is very interesting. It would be interesting to see sort of a retelling of that story where, like, maybe he stops somebody from doing this right before it happens, or there's some sort of other, like, more plausible explanation to the
sure.
wildness of this story. But it cracks me up anytime, because anytime I meet, like, a children's ministry director or a youth director, they're like, yeah, St. Nicholas has a lot of great stories, and they'll, like, start telling, and then they'll get to that one, they're like, yeah, not that one though, and then they'll skip over it.
See, I want the cinematic version of this to be like he walks up to the house and, like, super dramatic music hits, and he turns around, and for some unexplicable reason it's Sunny, and then he puts on sunglasses and he just says, I'm here to save the children. And then in the background you just hear Highway to the Santa Zone.
No. 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 I'm gonna put that out of my mind. But the thing, because I know I had mentioned this the last time when I was sharing about St. Leo the Great, that when I'm reading hagiographical work or doing any studies on saints, I try to, like, pick out symbolism that is repetitive throughout their story. And the thing about St. Nicholas that ties to this particularly wild story is it emphasizes that rule of three for all of his miracles. So, like, with the dowries, there are three daughters.
Yeah.
With these students, there are three children. You know, with those sailors, there are three sailors.
Yeah.
Right.
So that sort of consistent, it just makes me think about, you know, the whole service to the stranger. You know, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was, you know, cold, you clothed me, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that idea of him serving people regardless of their station, regardless of their situation, and very, very honestly, then serving Christ in that way, or serving God in that way, and seeing that visually represented with the number of three, I think is really beautiful. You know, because you wonder, like, how sort of cognizant that was, he was of that sort of pattern as he was doing these acts of service, or if that's just, you know, like a polishing of the story later on. But I still think it's really beautiful imagery.
Yeah. So I'm actually really glad that you brought that up, because I saw a reference to that story. I just didn't have an opportunity to find it.
It's a crazy one.
And dig
I just
into
love
it.
Bringing it up because it's so buck wild.
Yeah, but I do have some hints as to maybe some of the origination of it. So you did remind me, it's buried in my notes, and that's why I forgot to mention it. But there is another story from during his lifetime about a time of famine within the region of Lycia. And basically there's a number of ships that happen to pass through Myra, again, a port city, on their way to the capital in Constantinople, delivering these huge loads of grain to the emperor. And basically what happens is they pull into Myra, and Nicholas comes down and he says, hey, we're in the midst of a famine. We need some of this food. Leave, you know, like a portion from each of the ships as they pass through. Just leave it behind, and I will, you know, write to Constantine. I will deal with that side of things. Just leave us some of this grain so that we have something to eat. And so basically he, you know, it takes some doing, but he convinces these ship captains to leave some of the grain behind. So each of the ships stops, drops off some of their grain, and then carries on. And basically the way the story ends is that by the time they reach Constantinople, they go to offload the grain and they have just as much as they always had, right? So it's very much the classic kind of fish and loaves type of story, which might have something to do with the same, you know, some of the pieces of the origin of that tale specifically.
Yeah.
I think the thing that's interesting is, again, there's a huge, it's hard because there could be, like I said, so much research done. I focused on his lifetime, but there's so much after the fact that I'm so curious about, because there were some references to basically some of the legends really developing as a device of hope and positivity, for lack of a better word, during the Dark Ages.
Yeah.
Like there was a resurgence of Nicholas legends as a result of, oh, the Dark Ages are really awful. Let's find some like positive things, tell some really positive stories. And so there's some speculation that a lot of the legends really started to develop around that time. And so it's quite possible that narrative, I mean, that to me, that feels very like 18th, 19th century,
right?
Starting to get into Grimm's fairy tales territory, right? Like that feels like it probably was in that era, you know, any time between about, you know, the 11th century to the like 18th, 19th century. It feels like it could have fallen anywhere within that time pretty easily. So that's interesting. Again, it's fun to see how like little details just transmute and change over time.
Yeah, I agree. I think the other thing that I really love about Saint Nicholas is it's a demonstration of stewardship in a way that I don't think we think about a lot. I think when we talk about stewardship, especially now, like in modernity, we talk about like the stewardship of the land and conservation efforts, or you know, being responsible for one's own finances and tithing. But here we see somebody who was born into wealth, who, I mean, doesn't go into a mendicant order, but still acknowledges their wealth and distributes in ways that they feel does a great amount of good. And often, and working within a system to make sure that people are taken care of. Like, for example, the daughters and the dowries.
Right.
I can only imagine what it would have been like to be one of those daughters marrying somebody and being like, really? You couldn't have done anything to have waived that fee. We had to like rely on this stranger. I could have been a prostitute. Are you kidding me?
Right.
Like I would be furious. But you see somebody working within unjust systems, but using their own privilege to serve others, but not, we're not seeing his privilege shamed in any regard. Like he still comes from a wealthy family. He doesn't suddenly, you know, give to the extent that he's impoverished himself. He serves to the best of his ability. And the reason, I guess, it's present of mind. Alan and I had recently watched the new adaptation of the Jane Austen book, Emma, which is not one that I think people often talk about. They typically focus on Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility. But Emma is really beautiful,
right?
Because it's another story of two wealthy people within a small community who are really responsible with their wealth and do a great deal of good with what they have to their local community. These people that they know, you know, very well, and are deeply involved in those small villages, to try to not shame anybody for their station. And there's a really good scene in which Emma does make a mistake socially, and she does do recompense for that social faux pas that she does that causes this woman shame. And it's just a really beautiful story of people who are of means, who are not immediately the antagonists in the story. I think a lot of us are very, very familiar and very comfortable with stories in which whoever is the wealthiest in the room is automatically the villain. And so it's nice to, not to say that we should be celebrating wealth, but to see what that could look like should you have the means and could still be following Christ in a really beautiful way and being a steward of a community with what you have.
Yeah.
And we've been really lucky to know people who come from means kind of like that, who do demonstrate that kind of generosity that does not cause or further a feeling of shame or guilt or burden. You know, it's not like they're capitalizing right. on loans with interest. They're just like, don't like put it out of your mind. This is going to do.
Don't worry about this thing.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's a really great example of, you know, people who might be listening to this podcast or who are Christians that have means that could be doing really great things with it and not feel shamed for just happening to have means.
Right, right. Well, and I think that's one of the things that I love, you know, comparing the stories of St. Nicholas to, you know, what we have in modern Santa Claus. And modern Santa Claus very much, really, truly was an invention of the 19th and 20th century to promote capitalism.
Right.
I mean, it really was like that. That is what happened. Mm-hmm. And that became a big part of how Santa Claus is shaped today. But I like to see these subtle ways in which we're reclaiming that story, right? These subtle shifts in which we're refocusing in on those core aspects of who Saint Nicholas was, which of course are the core aspects of who Santa Claus should be, you know.
Yeah.
Actually it's cool. I'm glad that we had some scheduling issues here, but because I did finally realize and have time to sit down and watch Klaus last night, uh-huh. Alan. And when you're right, you're right. That movie is phenomenal. I loved it so much. Like I had a hard time. I actually had to look and then I went, wait, how did I not realize this? Because for whatever reason, J.K. Simmons as Klaus kept reminding me of Pacha in Emperor's New Groove, and I had to like double check myself, and I was like, no, it's John Goodman is Pacha. Why does it feel like these are the same person, the same voice actor in this movie? But I just had like hardcore Emperor's New Groove vibes from that film for whatever reason. But no, I love the way that he's portrayed in that movie, mm-hmm. especially like he's dealt with a loss, you know, and that's different from most other stories, but just the evolution of his generosity and kind of his return to generosity, I think is really cool. And framing that with the script of this well-to-do kid who's snobby and doesn't want to be here. And, you know, like, I think that created a really, I mean, it was an excellent juxtaposition, and it just provided such a great framework for the development of that story. So I love seeing those little things that we're starting to see come out of our modern narratives that are shifting us back in that direction.
Right. Yeah. That, and I love any story that allows for people to be generous without having to have learned how to be generous out of hardship. That people could just be kind and not have to have learned a hard lesson to get there. Like, it's great cinematically, and that's part of, I think, why the three of us all have come to love Klaus. But there is something nice about just realizing that there are good people that just want to be good people because mm-hmm. it's you know, faithful to Christ, and also it's just a nice thing to do.
Right. Yeah. Well, and it's so contrary to our steadily more jaded society now, in which everybody's out for something, right? Everybody's in it for something, which the film does play with too, and I think that's a great thing about it, is it's a very subtle, kind of delicate social commentary in that way.
Yeah,
definitely.
So if we were to same question then from last time we did this, if Saint Nicholas was to sit down at the D&D table with us, what would he play as? Or if we were to create a character for him, what would it be?
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. This one was really tough, too. I've been thinking about it for days, and I don't feel any closer to a conclusion.
This one, actually, I got thoughts.
Okay.
Cast him. I would actually go human. Like, I would keep it consistent there. I'd go psionic.
Of course you would.
Because think about it.
Of course you would.
Telekinesis. He knows when you're naughty or nice.
Sure.
He knows the things that you want, whether you send them to him.
Telepathy, not telekinesis.
Sorry. But telepathy, yes. Yeah.
If we're going to get scientific about it.
He can, depending on what kind of avenues you take within the psionic class, or at least the first build, they've stripped it down, but the build that in the glass dagger that
Unearthed
we're playing
Arcana.
With, is the original one from 2017, late 2017, early 2018. Okay. There's transmutation spells that you can take too, so you can do diminution, so you can shrink to a tiny size and increase then, and it's like one action, so if every round is 6 seconds, you can drop down a chimney in 6 seconds. Like, you could just go bloop, like that. That all makes sense.
Yeah, I guess.
You like invisibility could be there to be able to like drop gold places.
Sure.
So I might go that route.
Okay.
Human psionic.
Okay. I see. I wouldn't go psionic. I was thinking artificer.
Ooh, that is another good choice.
I didn't even think about
that. You have to
that.
Have resources Ooh. To be able, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have to have the means with which to get the tools and the materials to make things.
And it makes the sleigh work, too.
Right, yeah, exactly, right. exactly. As far as right. race is concerned, I was torn a lot, and because I was trying to avoid going
human. Yeah.
Which I don't think that's like a bad interpretation. I was just trying to come up with something like a little more
creative.
Out there. Because there's still, again, I don't want to land into stereotypes with the races, but I think I would want to go something that's like more like hulky rather than sort of like soft.
Firbolg.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
He's a firbolg.
I was just thinking
a playable Yeti. So like a firbolg. Like,
see, because originally I was like, could firbolg, you make like a Goliath, but like smaller? But I like firbolg way more.
Yep. Because they're already. So the thing that I like, because I think there's a little bit of this that floats around too, is that like natural connection. This is very much a Klaus thing.
Yeah.
But I like that kind of idea of a kind of connection to nature in the natural world. Of course I do. I'm a druid. But. but I can see it like that. That feels true of him. That kind of classic firbolg shepherding type of personality, you know. That feels like that captures that.
I love that. I really love that.
So firbolg artificer?
Yeah. I'm comfortable with that. I feel
I like that a lot.
I think he might even take like a level or two of rogue. Like just a dab. Like just enough to where he's
sneaky enough
to slip into houses and leave stuff behind, right? Like he's not going like sneak attack, assassinate people, but
yeah, I think that's perfect. I think I remember a couple of years ago somebody creating a mock-up character sheet for Saint Nick, and it was rogue, which I think is perfect just to take like a few levels in rogue. But I do like imagining, again, if this like real historical person sat down at the table to play this game that is entirely anachronistic to their life story.
Right.
Just like how confused he'd be. I can't tell if he'd be like amused by it, being like, this is a great time of fellowship. This is a very strange game. Or if he's like trying to read the stats on what a firbolg is. Like,
it's so good. I'm trying to think now. Absolutely. That Kyle's put rogue on my radar, I'm just trying to think what a Santa assassination would look like. Like, not actually assassinate, but like a Santa. I feel like the only thing that it could be is like a perfect snowball. So like you...
Well, for Santa, sure.
Right. So if he tries to use his assassinate ability, it's... gets up real close and like gets their attention and just pummels. It's not actually death. It's just pummeling them in the face like perfectly with a snowball, and then some sort of effect that happens because of that, like paralysis or blindness for a round, as you have to get rid of the snow out of your eyes.
For Santa, yes. For Saint Nicholas, I can't imagine that.
No.
Right.
But that Crozier's got some mad stats.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. that staff is stacked.
Yeah, I don't see St. Nicholas really doing, like, I imagine he just, like, always forgets that sneak attack is a thing. He doesn't care. He never wants to use it. So he's just good at sneaking around, but he never actually attacks while he's sneaking. He's just like, I'm going to creep over here and drop this, like, bag of money.
Right.
Like, he would probably be a thief archetype, but he would do exactly the opposite, where he just leaves stuff everywhere.
We'd be, like, going through a dungeon and, like, going through and taking out hobgoblins and orcs and like little goblins and stuff, and he'd be like, okay, but they're born out of a society that treats them unfairly. They have no other courses of action. I'm going to leave them a scholarship so they can go to Bard College.
Yep.
So the entire campaign is essentially an anti-heist.
Basically.
It's how can we sneak St. Nick in so he can deposit goods and get out without being noticed, without triggering any alarms.
That's exactly. That's it. That's the tweet.
That are going back to the dungeon crawl idea. We're all running through, like, raiding chests, digging out all this treasure, and, like, as we open stuff and, like, loot all of the cash out of the chests, he, like, comes behind us and just, like, keeps, like, constantly trying to clean up after us. Like, guys, this was somebody's house. Leave their stuff alone.
Yes.
Put it back.
I think we've just set the Great Christmas one-off campaign, anti-heist.
Kyle, I have to tell you, you're doing a great job starting to like create that idea because we've already gotten requests to join that game.
I'm not gonna lie. Obviously, it's not happening this year, but I have some thoughts, and this is something we might have to visit.
Yeah, I think
I am 100% on board.
We've already got people claiming seats. So
absolutely. Yeah. I'm not going to make it a promise at this point, but I'm just going to say I have a year to write this thing and the juices are flowing. So
nice. Well, on that, dear Mampersands, we would love to hear from you. MinMaxPod@gmail.com, MinMaxPod on all the socials. Except Reddit, where we're /u/minmaxpodcast. 773-789-9369 is the voicemail for voicemails 3 minutes or less. Anything longer than that, send that audio file over to the email. I'm at Alan H. Mowers. Ashley's at DEEDEE_K. Kyle is at Stainbrook Kyle. And folks, tomorrow's Christmas.
Have a beautiful holiday. That's the nicest
Absolutely.
I'm ever going to be to you.
There's Ashley practicing her generosity, folks.
you get one episode.
We'll see you next week, Mampersands.
Merry Christmas to all, and
Merry Christmas.
A good night.